This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Arizona's controversial new immigration law is just one of several controversial new laws passed by the state legislature this session. Journalist Howard Fisher says this year, the stars have finally aligned for fiscal and political conservatives in Arizona. Fisher has been covering Arizona state politics since 1982. He now runs the company Capital Media Services, and he reports for news institutions around the state, including Arizona Public Radio. Arizona Governor Jan Brewer signed the immigration bill into law on April 23rd, and it ignited a debate across the U.S. and Mexico. The new law requires police to question people about their immigration status if there's reason to suspect they're in the country illegally. After protests about the probability of racial profiling, a modification was passed that says race or ethnicity cannot be the basis for questioning a person, and that an officer can only ask for a person's papers if the officer has already stopped the person while enforcing another law. Also, according to the new law, a legal immigrant who is stopped but is not carrying their immigration papers can be charged with a misdemeanor. Immigrants unable to produce documents showing they're in the U.S. legally could be arrested, jailed for up to 6 months, and fined $2,500. It's up to the local police to decide if they'll keep the immigrant in prison or turn them over to federal officials. Some local police departments don't want to carry out the law, but another provision states that citizens can file lawsuits against police departments or other government agencies if they're not enforcing the law. Arizona has an estimated 460,000 illegal immigrants and is the nation's busiest border crossing point. Howard Fisher, welcome to Fresh Air. The immigration bill is one of several very conservative laws that have been passed in this session of the Arizona State Legislature. Can we just run through a few of those bills? Let's start with guns. What did the Arizona State Legislature pass about guns?
Oh, we were very busy with guns out here. The most sweeping would allow any adult to carry a concealed weapon without bothering to get a state permit, which means no training, no background check. Only two other states actually allow that now, Alaska and Vermont, and clearly much smaller states. There's also a bill that the governor signed which said, if you manufacture a gun in Arizona, you can possess it in Arizona without those pesky federal firearms regulations. There's another bill also on her desk to preempt local gun regulations that are stricter. This is a governor who believes very much in the Second Amendment as she sees it. She spoke last year to the National Rifle Association National Convention, and she believes that there is an unrestricted right to carry weapons, and most lawmakers apparently go along.
So in other words, if you want to carry a concealed weapon, you don't need a permit, you don't need training, you don't need to be registered?
Up until now in Arizona, you could carry, anyone can carry openly, and that was a laws that date back to territorial days. You want to walk around the street with a 45 strapped to your hip and everyone can see it, you're free to do that. If you want to carry a concealed weapon, you had to go through certain basic training, how to handle the weapon, knowing when you can use deadly physical force. You also had to undergo a background check. Under the law that takes effect on July 29th, any adult who is allowed to carry a gun, in other words, you're not a convicted felon or something like that, will be able to carry concealed. The argument is, well, what's the difference whether you have the gun outside your jacket or underneath your jacket? There are obviously some folks who are very concerned that if everyone starts carrying concealed, will there be more threats on each other? There are other people who are saying, look, it's a right not just under the Second Amendment. Arizona actually has a version of the Second Amendment that's even more absolute than the federal constitution. The federal constitution talks about a well-regulated militia. Arizona's constitution said there is an absolute right of Arizonans to bear arms in defense of themselves and the state. And there are a lot of people who believe whether it's open or concealed, it's the same right. Clearly, this governor also believes that, and that's why she signed the bill.
What about ethnic studies? There's a new law about that in Arizona.
One of the larger school districts in the state, in Tucson, has an ethnic studies program. The idea behind it, according to the proponents, is that you build a certain amount of ethnic pride among the Hispanic students. And again, a city like Tucson, which is an old Spanish presidio, was part of Mexico long before it was part of Arizona, has a population down there that perhaps would do better with looking at the contributions of Latinos to the culture. The concern has been that somehow, instead of building ethnic pride, it's building ethnic solidarity and perhaps a reverse racism. And so the legislature has enacted a bill to say you cannot have a course that teaches hatred of any other race, which sounds great on paper. And Tucson Unified School District insists they're not doing that now. The devil obviously is in the details, and we're going to see what happens because the state school superintendent out here has already said if the ethnic studies program in Tucson continues under this new law, he will take them to court and he will take it apart.
And there's a new abortion law that was passed in Arizona.
Yes, they obviously can't go very far into overturning Roe versus Wade, but they've nibbled around the edges. There's some new reporting requirements. And then there's another one to tighten up on existing state law that prohibits public funding for abortions. This one goes after some cities where, if you're an employee, you can get insurance coverage that includes elective abortion. This new law says no public funds in any way, shape, or form can go into funding an abortion, even if it's only part of the coverage that you're getting as a city employee. How that's going to affect city coverage is going to be very tricky because they're going to have to start separating out that kind of coverage. This is not unusual for Arizona. The state has been tiptoeing around the edges of that for a while. We also have some new bills on embryonic research. And I want you to know that officially now in Arizona, you cannot produce human-animal hybrids. So if anyone was worried that we're going to be creating minotaurs or mermaids in Arizona, I want you to know that's now against the law here.
Why was that passed, a bill making it illegal to create human-animal hybrids? Had anybody suggested that they wanted to create human-animal hybrids?
There are some folks here who are very worried that, left to their own devices, scientists will look at the old Jurassic Park question that Jeff Goldblum asked, which is, the question isn't can we, the question is should we? And sometimes science does get ahead of the ethics, and the lawmakers here are very concerned that somehow some public monies would be used or even private monies would be used to do research into something that they consider to be ethically improper. Now, where's the line on that? I don't see anybody creating minotaurs, but I certainly see scientists who would like to use animal genes to perhaps cure certain human conditions. Whether this bill precludes that remains to be seen.
One more bill I want to mention before we get to immigration. That is, Arizona Governor Jan Brewer signed legislation giving her the power to sue the federal government over the new health care legislation. Explain that.
What happened was we have a Republican governor in Jan Brewer and a Democratic attorney general in Terry Goddard. Terry Goddard looked at the new federal law and concluded that there was no constitutional violation there. There was no mandate on states to do anything because it came down to the golden rule. If you want the federal government's gold, you live by their rules. Jan Brewer clearly didn't see it that way and wanted to make a political statement. You have to remember that both Brewer and Goddard are running for governor this year, and so she got the Republican-controlled legislature to give her the authorization to join with the more than a dozen other states to go ahead and sue the federal government to try to argue that this is an unconstitutional mandate. It's beyond the scope of the federal government to control. It's beyond questions of interstate commerce, which is within Congress's control. And obviously, we'll see on the national level what a federal judge and ultimately the U.S. Supreme Court decides.
So Arizona seems to be headed legislatively in a very conservative direction. Governor Jan Brewer is Republican. She was preceded by Janet Napolitano, who's now the head of Homeland Security. And Napolitano is a Democrat. Are there bills that she would have vetoed if they came to her desk, if Napolitano's desk? In other words, is there a big shift going on now in Arizona, a shift since Janet Napolitano left?
There is definitely a shift. In fact, some of the bills that are being signed now are ones that Janet Napolitano did veto, in terms of easing the concealed carry laws, in terms of some of the abortion laws. Janet Napolitano took a much more liberal, to the extent it's liberal and conservative issues in here, liberal view of the role of government, what it should be doing, and the individual rights, the whole 10th Amendment states' rights argument. And so these are bills that have been pent up. 6 years of Janet Napolitano has left a lot of very frustrated Republican lawmakers. You have to remember, the legislature has been in Republican hands pretty much steadily since the 1960s, with a few exceptions. But we have elected Democratic governors. The Arizona voters seem to like that split government. We've had Bruce Babbitt, again, fairly liberal person. We've had Rose Mofford. We've had Janet Napolitano. But now, because of this peculiar accident, if you will, of politics, Janet Napolitano became the Homeland Security Secretary. Jan Brewer, the elected Secretary of State, became the governor once Janet quit. Nobody elected Jan Brewer governor, but she's the governor now, and the Republican-controlled legislature is bound and determined to take advantage of that because it may not last. As I mentioned, there's going to be a very divisive race this year. Brewer has three other Republicans running against her in the primary. Whoever survives that will likely run against Democrat Terry Goddard. And I think that the thought of Republican lawmakers of Governor Terry Goddard scares the you-know-what out of them, so they figured, you know, you got to strike while the iron's hot.
So this is the context in which the immigration bill was passed in Arizona.
This is the context of the immigration bill, because many of these bills, including the immigration bills, had been up before. For example, one of the provisions in the bill deals with day laborers, where the people can stop on streets to pick up day laborers near your Home Depot stores. Janet Napolitano vetoed that legislation. It's now part of the new immigration bill that's gotten all the national attention. Some of the issues about identification cards, the issues about quote-unquote sanctuary cities, one of the provisions in Senate Bill 1070 says it is illegal for a city to have a policy that precludes its police officers from enforcing federal immigration laws to the full extent permitted. Janet Napolitano vetoed that bill, said it's none of the business of local police to be enforcing federal immigration law. In fact, she said it actually works against local police because victims and witnesses won't come forward. Now it's part of the bill that Jan Brewer signed. And so there is a sea change that's occurred here in Arizona because of the shift of who's in charge.
Yeah, now let's talk more about the immigration bill. Basically, immigration is a federal issue. It's federal law. It's the Immigration and Naturalization Service, the INS, that oversees that. So what does it mean to make it a state crime to be in this country in violation of federal immigration laws?
I think what you're seeing is a certain amount of frustration that the federal government has not done the job. And particularly in the case of Arizona, we have seen over the years the hardening of the border in California. It used to be you could run across the line right at Tijuana without any problem, or at Otay Mesa or something. Getting across the river in Rio Grande in Texas was fairly easy. Those have been hardened. That leaves 370 miles of Arizona-Sonora border, much of which is three strands of barbed wire. And so all of that pent-up demand in this country for labor, all of the drug traffic is now traveling through Arizona. And so we've seen an increase in shootings. We've seen an increase in border crime. We've seen an increase in the number of drop houses. And it's a frustration that's taken place that if the federal government isn't going to do the job, if they're not going to add more border patrol, if they're not going to do more to catch illegals, that the state should do something. And again, remember, this isn't the first time Arizona has done something. Back in 2006, Arizona enacted the first ever employer sanctions law, which makes it a state crime for an employer to knowingly hire an undocumented worker. And the idea being, if we can't block the border because we don't have the troops to send down there, then at least try to get rid of some of the magnet. This is a product of years of frustration. I mean, I've lived in southern Arizona. I've lived within 10 miles of the border. And it's not the old days where a few farm workers would come through and they'd stay for a few weeks and go back. You now have a criminal element coming in with drugs and coming back with guns. And a lot of people have had it and said, what can the state do? This they believe, is the answer.
So looking at the new Arizona, the controversial new Arizona immigration law, do you think that the Department of Justice will be challenging it because Arizona is, you know, requiring its police to investigate the legality of people who they may suspect of being illegal immigrants? But the whole immigration law is basically a federal issue, not a state issue.
I think there are going to be two basic legal challenges. You hit on one of them, which is what the lawyers like to call field preemption. In other words, the federal government has determined only we set the policy of who is entitled to be in this country legally. Now, there are exceptions. I mentioned earlier Arizona's employer sanctions law. And in fact, Congress did build an exception in to allow states to take away the business licenses of companies that knowingly hire undocumented workers. And the Ninth Circuit has upheld Arizona's law in there. The argument of the proponents is that they are simply enforcing what's already federal law. They're not changing the law. They're not broadening the law in terms of who can be here illegally. And Senator Russell Pierce, who crafted the measure, said that there is an inherent authority of local police to enforce federal law. And he claims to have the case law to back that up. I would be very surprised if the Justice Department did not challenge that. We already know that the Mexican American Legal Defense and Educational Fund is going to challenge it along with the ACLU. The second legal issue is going to be whether the law results in racial profiling. Now, that's going to be what the lawyers like to call an as-applied challenge, that once the law takes effect, assuming it does take effect, whether people are being stopped by virtue of the fact that they're brown. And you, while the law specifically says racial profiling is illegal, it's illegal under the U.S. Constitution. The law, after it was passed, was further amended to say you may not use race, ethnicity, or national origin as a basis to stop someone. Okay, well then what do you use as a basis to stop someone to ask questions about whether they're here illegally? You know, if you happen to be 6'2 and blonde, odds of you being questioned are probably a lot less than if you happen to be 5'3 and dark-skinned. And so it's going to be a really tricky, real tricky question in terms of how do police enforce this without it being racial profiling. And I'm sure there'll be a challenge on that also.
Arizona's controversial new immigration bill was sponsored by Russell Pierce. Tell us a little bit about him.
Russell is very conservative. I mean, his background is law enforcement. He was a sheriff's deputy. He was a justice of the peace. He has a child who was shot by an illegal immigrant. Russell sees things in very black and white ways. I mean, I don't think there's racism there. I mean, Russell's son married a Hispanic woman. He's got Hispanic grandchildren. I've never seen Russell mistreat anybody personally in all the years I've known him based on race, color, ethnicity. But Russell sees it in a very black and white way. If you ask for a single line that describes one of Russell's quotes, it's what part of illegal don't you understand? You shouldn't be in this country. We're going to do what we can to enforce the rule of law. That's the way Russell sees things. And he's obviously been tarred with being racist and everything else. Again, I think that's oversimplifying what's a much more complex problem. I think he believes that there's financial burden on the state. We talked a little bit about the number of kids in schools. We know that perhaps 17% of all prisoners in state prison are illegal immigrants who violated state law. Now, here's where it gets interesting. The federal government has the State Criminal Alien Assistance Program. They are supposed to reimburse the states for the cost of housing illegal immigrants in state prisons. The federal government has reimbursed the states pennies on the dollar. So the feds haven't even stepped up for that. So Russell said, if you're not going to step up, then we're going to do what we need to do. And he sees it, again, as a law enforcement officer.
Just one more question. Arizona does not practice daylight savings time, which I'm sure makes it really confusing when you do things with people who are out of state. So why don't they recognize daylight savings time?
Well, the running joke out here is that there are lawmakers who believe that daylight savings time is a communist plot. And I'm sure there are probably a few of them who do. I suppose the more practical answer is, if you're in a state where it goes up to 120 during the day, the last thing you need in the middle of summer is another hour of daylight.
Arizona politics is so controversial now. Is it hard for you to report on Arizona politics without becoming partisan?
Well, you have to look at it, I suppose, through an eye of that this is a show being put on for my benefit. I know that sounds very self-centered as a journalist, but I've been covering the legislature since 1982. I've been in covering politics since 1970. And you have to just look at it as with sort of bemusement. There are always characters that come through Arizona politics. We had a birther bill this year, for example, that actually got out of the House that said if Barack Obama wants to run for re-election, he'd actually have to produce a birth certificate to the satisfaction of our Secretary of State before he could be on the ballot here. I can't make this stuff up. We had a lawmaker named Barbara Bluster who a number of years ago put out a memo equating homosexuality with bestiality and cannibalism, who also went up to Senator Barbara Leff, who's a Jewish senator from Paradise Valley, and said to her, "You can't be Jewish. You don't have a hooked nose. How can you can't make this stuff up?" I love covering Arizona politics.
Well, good luck with your continued coverage. Howard Fisher, thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
Howard Fisher runs Capital Media Services and reports on Arizona state politics for Arizona Public Radio and news organizations around the state. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. As investigators continue to probe the attempted car bombing in Times Square, there are increasing concerns that radical groups based in Pakistan may have played a role. Court documents indicate that suspect Faisal Shahzad admitted traveling to the Waziristan region of Pakistan for training in bomb making. Our guest David Rode believes North Waziristan has become the prime sanctuary for extremists who launch attacks against American troops in the region, extremists who are increasingly capable of planning and supporting terrorist attacks in the United States. It's a region David Rode knows all too well. He covered Afghanistan and Pakistan from 2001 to 2008 and was held captive for 7 months by the Taliban, mostly in North Waziristan. While he was there, he saw radical groups training their followers and foreign extremists in making bombs. David Rode is on leave from the New York Times while he works on a book about his experiences. He spoke this morning with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies.
Well, David Rode, welcome back to Fresh Air. When you heard that Faisal Shahzad, the man who has been arrested in connection with the failed New York Times Square car bombing, had been trained in Pakistan, what was your reaction?
I was disappointed. For years, myself and other reporters have been writing about North Waziristan, and we've seen attacks in Kabul linked back to North Waziristan. We've seen assassination attempts in Pakistan linked back there. We saw the killing of Benazir Bhutto, the 2005 London subway bombings, and now, you know, an attack in Times Square. And it's been 8 years, and the area just continues to be a Taliban mini-state.
And this is an area that's in what people refer to as the border regions of Pakistan, near Afghanistan, right?
Yeah, the tribal areas are sort of the result of decades of really poor British colonial policy, poor Pakistani government policy, and actually also American government policy. They've been this neglected backward area where people weren't allowed to vote. They are essentially cut off from the rest of Pakistan, and political parties are barred from being active there. And it was used by the United States as a base to train and indoctrinate young Afghans and Pakistanis to fight Soviet troops in Afghanistan in the 80s. So what we face today is really the product of 30 years of conflict and beyond that sort of decades of neglect.
And it's in effect a Taliban mini state, right?
Yeah, what really struck me when I was brought there as a captive was that the Taliban regime that the U.S. felt it had toppled in Afghanistan in 2001, I found had simply moved a few hundred miles to the east, and it was alive and thriving in the tribal areas of Pakistan, particularly in two agencies, as they're called. There are parts of the tribal areas, North Waziristan and South Waziristan. There were Taliban road crews repairing the roads, Taliban police patrolling the streets, the Taliban run the schools, and Arab and Uzbek foreign militants stroll through the bazaars with complete confidence. And it really is a completely militant-run state.
Now, when you were on the show before, you talked about your captivity in the hands of the Taliban. You were taken in Afghanistan when you were en route to interview a Taliban leader. And you said that you were, if I recall, you were held by a group associated with a man named Sirajuddin Haqqani. Am I getting that name right?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. Tell us about him and who he is and what his role is in the jihadist movement.
The interesting thing about Sirajuddin Haqqani is, again, he's an incredibly important figure now, and he's also a small history lesson. His father, Jalaluddin Haqqani, was one of the Mujahideen fighters that the United States backed during the 1980s. And Congressman Charlie Wilson, who was the focus of the movie Charlie Wilson's War, actually visited the Haqqanis, Jalaluddin Haqqani, the father, and stayed in Miram Shah, the place where I was held prisoner, and actually went into Afghanistan with Haqqani's fighters in the 80s. And he was so impressed by Haqqani's men that he called Jalaluddin Haqqani, Sirajuddin's father, the personification of good. Fast forward 30 years later, the son is now kind of running the operation. And what happened is that while Jalaluddin Haqqani was working with the United States, he was also working very closely with Osama bin Laden. Osama bin Laden's first camp in Afghanistan was based on territory controlled by Jalaluddin Haqqani. So when the United States attacked in 2001, it's thought that Jalaluddin Haqqani may have been one of the persons that helped Osama bin Laden sneak over the border and go into Pakistan. And he, you know, Osama bin Laden today may be based in North Waziristan. And Sirajuddin is a younger generation of Haqqanis. He's in his early 30s. And he's sort of grown up in this milieu of Arab and hardline foreign militants. And he just posted a sort of question and answer session on the internet where he was sort of reaching out to other Muslim radicals, talking about the oppression of Muslims in Chechnya and calling for them to fight to retake Jerusalem from the Crusaders and encouraging jihadists in Somalia and many different places around the world, Iraq and the Caucasus. So it's, you know, it's again, it's a family that was helped by the United States originally and has now sort of turned into this Frankenstein.
So we have this father-son organization, which was active in helping the United States fight the Soviets way back then. We're close to Osama bin Laden, and now the next generation has this very militant base in North Waziristan, this area of Pakistan, where it appears a lot of the training for some of these terrorist attacks has been occurring, right?
Yeah, my guards would take turns. You know, several would stay and guard us when we were prisoners, and the others would go and get bomb-making lessons from Uzbek militants. They were taught how to make roadside bombs that they would, you know, then cross the border into Afghanistan and use to kill American soldiers. There was young Afghans and Pakistanis who were also being sort of indoctrinated and trained to be suicide bombers. During these bomb-making classes, large explosions would go off in the middle of Miran Shah. That's the largest town in North Waziristan. And there are Pakistani military bases, but the Pakistani soldiers essentially never came off the bases. And we'd hear these explosions. There'd be no reaction. And my guards were very relaxed and very excited about these classes. I remember one day one of them came back and he had skinned his knee running away from a big explosive they had been setting off with a timer. And they were just completely confident and comfortable and at ease in North Waziristan.
Yeah, I want to talk a little bit more about the role of the Pakistani military in all of this. But you were actually at this area where it appears that Faisal Shahzad, the man accused in the Times Square attempted car bombing, was trained. And you firsthand, you saw firsthand bomb-making training and explosives operations going on.
I did. I mean, I heard about it. I was always kept in houses, but I just my guards brought back their notebooks from their bomb-making classes and, you know, talked about what they were learning. And it was sort of eerie in that the notebooks they had, the diagrams they had for bombs were very similar to notebooks that myself and other journalists had found in Kabul in 2001 when the Taliban fell. And we had found these houses that were used by militants for training. And it was the, you know, exact same sort of classes that had been carried out in Kabul before 2001. And again, you know, this entire training infrastructure had simply moved from Afghanistan into North Waziristan.
And just to clarify to folks who might be just tuning in, you were there not really as a journalist but as a captive and therefore had a look inside this camp that a journalist wouldn't readily get. So we've been talking about this organization, the Haqqani Group, these militants that are in North Waziristan. And of course, after the Times Square incident, there was a video released in which the Pakistani Taliban claimed credit. What's the relationship between the Haqqani Group and the Pakistani Taliban?
One of the things that was clearest to me in my time in captivity was that the Haqqanis and the Pakistani Taliban work seamlessly together. There are some Pakistani military officers that differentiate between the two groups. They are believed to tacitly support the Haqqanis because they see the Haqqanis as assets that Pakistan can use to exert Pakistan's influence in Afghanistan and prevent India from gaining influence in Afghanistan. And there's been frustration among American officials because the Pakistani military will crack down on the Pakistani Taliban, who they see as enemies of the Pakistani state, yet they won't crack down on the Haqqani network. And one of the fears is that one of the reasons that the Pakistanis have not gone into North Waziristan yet and why it's the only place that they have not mounted an offensive is because it is the base of the Haqqanis, who they still see as proxies they can use. One of the telling moments of our captivity was the Haqqanis were worried about drone strikes. They believe the drone strikes are actually trying to kill me, and they saw me as a very valuable hostage. So they actually moved me from their territory, North Waziristan, to the territory of the Pakistani Taliban in South Waziristan. And we were actually held in a district controlled by Baitullah Masood, the head of the Pakistani Taliban. He was killed actually in August 2009 in a drone strike. But, you know, our fear was, oh, no, the Haqqani network is going to, sell us to the Pakistani Taliban or we would be kidnapped by the Pakistani Taliban. We saw them as rival groups. But instead, our Haqqani guards brought us to the Pakistani Taliban's territory. They were welcomed there. We were given a house to stay in. And the Pakistani Taliban sort of provided area security while our Haqqani guards live with us. And then when we left and went back to North Waziristan, the sort of stronghold of the Haqqanis, the Pakistani Taliban let us go. Again, the two groups work seamlessly together. And I think more broadly speaking, they sort of support each other. The Haqqanis are very strong in North Waziristan, and I think they're giving shelter both to Arab militants and to Pakistani Taliban now in North Waziristan.
Well, David wrote, it sounds as if you believe that there's a serious security threat to the United States from the activities in North Waziristan. And the United States has put a lot of pressure on Pakistan to pursue military operations against the Taliban, and they've done a lot of that over the last year. Are they doing anything in North Waziristan?
Defense Secretary Robert Gates in January went to Pakistan and specifically urged an offensive in North Waziristan because, again, it seems to be the one last stronghold of all these different militant groups. And the response of the Pakistani army was that they did not have enough troops. They were overstretched and they would only be able to launch an offensive in 6 to 12 months. What's surprised some observers was that the Pakistani army just recently held a military exercise on the border with India with more than 50,000 troops. And many people point to that and say the Pakistani army has, definitely has enough troops to carry out an offensive. It's just that it continues to see India as its primary enemy and is not, facing the militancy that's such a tremendous problem up in the border areas. So, yes, there are 50,000 Pakistani troops sitting on the border with India, yet the Pakistani army says they don't have enough troops to move into North Waziristan.
Do you think it's more a matter of preserving resources so that it has a force to be pointed at India, or is it that they also see the Haqqani group and groups like that as of strategic value to Pakistan and the region?
I think it's both. One current in the years I covered Pakistan was a deep distrust Pakistanis felt towards the United States. They felt that after being very active in the region in the 80s and frankly helping spread some of the fundamentalism that's such a problem now during the anti-Soviet jihad, that the U.S. basically abandoned the region when the Soviets withdrew from Afghanistan in 1989, and they feel that the United States will abandon the region again. So they want to hold their cards. They want to have forces deployed to counter any threat from India, and they want to continue to have the Haqqanis as potential proxies in Afghanistan. There's rumblings now that they might launch an offensive. This was actually before the Times Square case. Clearly, this increases the pressure on them to launch an offensive. And one other piece of reporting we found was that the United States has provided more than $5 billion in reimbursements to the Pakistani military for operations in the tribal areas. And a lot of that money was overcharging, we found, and Pentagon auditors found. So I think it's a difficult situation for U.S. officials. They can't publicly criticize the Pakistanis. That tends to just not be effective and frustrate them. Lecturing them doesn't really get much results. But this is clearly a critical time, and there's clearly a great deal of frustration in Washington about North Waziristan.
Now, last summer, the Taliban leader Batilla Massoud was killed in a drone strike, which I don't know if the Americans ever actually acknowledged credit for, but it was widely believed that that's what happened. And this was seen by a lot of analysts as an important victory in the fight against terrorism in that part of the world. What's your sense of the impact of the killing of Batilla Massoud?
I think the killing of Batilla Massoud did have a significant impact. And, you know, I saw firsthand in North and South Waziristan that the drone strikes do have a major impact. They generally are accurate. The strikes that went on killed foreign militants or Afghan or Pakistani Taliban that went on around us. There were some civilians killed, but generally the Taliban would greatly exaggerate the number of civilians killed. They inhibited their operations. Taliban leaders were very nervous about being tracked by drones. So they are effective in the short term, I would say. They do eliminate some top leaders. But as we've seen with Batilla Massoud, new leaders emerge. And I think the only long-term solution is to have Pakistani forces in North Waziristan regain control of that area. I don't think the answer is, you know, endless drone strikes. The answer is definitely not sending American troops into Pakistan and into the tribal areas. That would just create a tremendous nationalist backlash. It has to be the Pakistanis doing it. And I want to be fair to the Pakistani army. They have lost 2,000 soldiers fighting the Taliban since 2001. That's twice as many Americans have died in Afghanistan since 2001. And going to North Waziristan will be a tremendously bloody fight. Again, you've got almost the most hardline fighters all holed up there. So it's a very serious thing. There are many, many brave Pakistani soldiers out there. We were able to escape because we did actually make it to one of these bases, and the brave Pakistani soldiers on that base let us inside. So I know there's criticism of the Pakistani military, and you know, clearly something needs to be done in North Waziristan, according to analysts. But you know, I don't want to not recognize the sacrifice of many, many Pakistani soldiers.
Sure. You know, I believe I've read somewhere that some analysts believe that the killing of Batilla Massoud, the Taliban leader, in some ways complicated things by leaving a vacuum of power which was filled by a lot of contending groups.
I would disagree with that. Batilla Massoud launched just a deadly wave of suicide bombings across Pakistan. More people died in terrorist-related attacks in Pakistan. Roughly 8,600 people were killed or wounded in 2009 than in Afghanistan or Iraq. And Batilla Massoud was believed to be behind the vast majority of those attacks. So there's no question that his killing, I think, you know, limited his organization's effectiveness. And it's really, you know, Pakistanis who are suffering the most from these attacks. You know, there's lots of talk of the drone strikes creating resentment against the United States. Polls show that, but polls also show that the one part of Pakistan that actually supports the drone strikes is the tribal areas. And what I saw as a prisoner was that the Taliban run a police state in the tribal areas. They're obsessed with local people spying on them and guiding the drone attacks. And at one point, there was a drone strike carried out just outside of our house. Two cars were hit. There were foreign and Pakistani militants in them. And they local Taliban and foreign Taliban arrested a local farmer, accused him of being a spy that had guided the attack. He denied it. They then disemboweled him and chopped off his leg. At some point during that, he, you know, allegedly confessed to being a spy. They then decapitated him and hung his body in a local market. You know, day after day, there were stories of local people being rounded up and executed by the Taliban. So they're incredibly oppressive, and I don't think they have much popular support in the tribal areas. The key is getting the Pakistani military and Pakistani government into the tribal areas, and finally giving the people in the tribal areas the economic and educational and political opportunities they haven't had for decades.
You know, I don't know if this is something you feel comfortable commenting on, but it struck me that if Faisal Shahzad had gone to these experienced explosives experts and bomb trainers in Pakistan, he certainly did an amateurish job of putting together a car bomb in New York. Does that make sense to you?
It does. I mean, it's very hard to explain the contradictions that I found in North Waziristan and the contradictions sort of inside these movements. They're very sophisticated in some ways. They were constantly searching the internet and getting lots of information, and they interact with the world. They read about it. You know, they're very effective at mounting their own propaganda. But then they were amateurish in other ways. So I'm not surprised that he got this kind of training and then seemed to carry out this sort of slapdash plot. You know, my guards were, you know, many of them were sort of poorly educated young Afghans who really hadn't seen the world beyond Afghanistan and Pakistan. One little anecdote that illustrates this situation there and this dichotomy: when I was in captivity in the spring of 2009, there was a gunman opened fire in an immigration office in upstate New York and killed about a dozen people. And at that time, the Pakistani Taliban took credit for that attack. My guards were elated at that time. They were firing their guns in the air. They were so excited at the prospect of payback to the United States and a successful attack in New York. Later, there was a radio broadcast that explained that the gunman was, in fact, a Vietnamese American. And my guards, you know, were puzzled, and they still assumed this was, you know, an attack carried out by this greater Taliban movement. And they turned to me and they said, you know, are Vietnamese people Muslims? And they just don't know. They know very little about the outside world, yet they're eager to kind of carry out these international attacks. So, you know, it didn't surprise me, this combination that was seen in the Times Square case of seeming international reach, but then some amateur aspects to how it was carried out.
You know, the other puzzling thing is, you know, it's been reported that Faisal Shahzad has been cooperating with authorities, and we've seen this in a number of other cases in the United States of alleged terrorists who, when captured, actually are quite forthcoming. Does that make sense to you?
Absolutely. I mean, one of the amazing things is the strength of the ideology that they follow. He's very proud of what he's done. He wants other militants to know what he's done. There's an entire sort of counter-narrative, starting with 9/11, which they view as a sort of American-Israeli plot that the United States secretly carried out the attacks on 9/11 to create a pretext for the United States to go occupy Muslim countries. There's this completely different worldview they have of the United States as this sort of greedy, nefarious, immoral country that's just stealing Muslim resources, forcing Muslims to convert to Christianity, just sort of dirty, animalistic West. And they really see themselves as defending their culture and their faith from this unprovoked onslaught from the West. And so I think he's very proud of what he's done. One of the things I saw with one young suicide bomber that was being trained there was that I would talk to him and I would say that I miss my family, and he would say, you know, why do you care so much about your family? The only relationship that matters is your relationship with God. And I saw that as these young men are indoctrinated, they're told to not care about their families and to focus more and more not on this life but on, you know, paradise where they'll be going after they achieve martyrdom. And what that does is it very practically kind of removes young men from the influences that might keep them from adopting radicalism, and it sort of moves them into this orbit where they're just completely focused on the next life. They have a sense of identity, a sense of passion. They're part of a great movement that's, you know, defending you know, a people that are being oppressed. And so I'm not surprised he's talking and that he's proud of what he's done.
Well, David Rode, thanks so much for sharing some of your insights with us.
Thank you.
David Rode spoke with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies. Rode is on leave from the New York Times while he writes a book. You can find a link to David Rode's New York Times series about being captured and held by the Taliban on our website, freshair.npr.org, where you can also download podcasts of our show.